Located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today in the first hour from a June 16th book launch at Time Out Bar and Bistro, you'll hear Meg Freer, who is the McDonald Institute's 2024-2025 Poet in Residence, read from and launch her new chapbook called Big Questions, Tiny Moments, and that was inspired by and grew out of that residency and her visits to Snow Lab. This multi-genre launch also includes music by Deborah Sherman's and readings by Shannon McConnell, Jane McDonald, and Sue Publicover. The event does run a few minutes into the second hour and will air uninterrupted. Then in the second hour, following the remainder of that launch, you'll hear the event was called Novel Idea and Youth Imagine the Future, Solarpunk, with store readings by author Jerry Jurit through the portal, and YIF Youth winner Jessie Paul reading her 2024 winning story. The event was emceed by Michelle Morningstar, assistant professor at Queen's University in psychology. Let's go ahead and up first from the tight show today. And from the first... up first, I should say, from a June 16th multi-genre book launch again at Time Out Bar and Bistro, here is Meg Freer. Launching her new book called Big Questions, Tiny Moments. Here we go.
The book launch for my little book, Big Questions, Tiny Moments, from Woodpecker Lane Press. I'm really pleased with how it turned out. Unfortunately, the publisher, Maureen Garvey from Woodpecker Lane Press, could not be here tonight. She's off in Westport and I haven't get back down here. But she sends her good wishes, and she did a really, really nice job putting this book together. It looks so nice. And we're going to get started with the... music. We'll start with some music from my colleague Deb Sherman's. She's going to just play a little bit of piano music. She's a composer, improviser, piano teacher, colleague of mine, and we collaborate together on a show which will be here in this location on a monthly basis. And we can say more about that later. So Deb's going to play a little bit of music and then we'll get on with the readings.
I'll say a little bit about this. The regular poetry improv people that come would know this. I've played it a few times. It's called Infinite. It's in three parts. And the first one's kind of ethereal, second one's kind of waltz, and the third one really moves. So it's in three parts. It's a bit long, and it's a piano piece. Thank you.
clue.
That's Deb Shermans, pianist, composer, improviser. Thank you, Deb. And I want to thank the McDonald Institute primarily for making this possible. I wouldn't be standing up here launching a book except for their generosity in offering me a residency for the past year to work with their staff and their faculty and their students and sit in on discussions and lectures and tour Snow Lab up in Sudbury, which was an amazing experience. Maybe not for the faint of heart, but pretty interesting. And so I really am indebted to the McDonald Institute and particularly Art McDonald, the namesake for the Institute, who is the spearhead for this, and Tony Noble, who's the director of the McDonald Institute, who are both here, as well as many of the staff and faculty of the physics department at Queen's and of the McDonald Institute. So I really want to thank Mark Richardson as well. We've got Zach Kenny here. Zach connected me with lots of people, did my posters. Mark also connected me with lots of people and generally made roads for me to travel to and from Sudbury and so on. Edward Thomas, the associate director of the McDonald Institute, was extremely helpful in setting the whole thing up and more or less drafting the way it would work. And professors, Aaron Vincent, I'll mention him in a minute. There are some other professors here who I didn't work with, but I'm really happy that they're here as well. And thank you to the Time Out Bar and Bistro for hosting us, and for the staff, for the servers, and for Jamie, the owner here, who's helping us with sound. We really appreciate you hosting us here. Really. Thank you. If anyone takes any decent photos or videos, please pass them on to me later. That would be wonderful. So I did not start out to be a science poet. In fact, I did not start out to be a poet at all. I am a musician and a music teacher. But when I started writing poetry, I found the language of science quite interesting. And this is the kind of science poetry, if you wanted to call it that, that I started out writing. So I'm just going to give you an example of what I wrote when I first started writing what I call science poetry. It's called Beyond Equilibrium. A man and woman trim their front lawns with scissors in different parts of the city, break their own limits, attempt invisible mending of the weather in their spinning minds. I get out the mapping pens, label the outliers, draw what is missing from other planets, complete the cosmic exit strategy. My airplane pretzel package notes the absence of peanuts. Its strong gravitational field warns me to keep fingertips away from the event horizon, or it will nibble my nails. If it turns Earth into a black hole, that will ruin the whole day. My margin of safety depends on a small slope in the floor. Thank you. So I wrote several poems of that type. And then I went to a lecture at the Vader Center by a physics Nobel laureate, not Art McDonald, but Dr. Barry Barish, who was the physics Nobel laureate a couple of years before Art. And he came and did what was billed as a general interest lecture for the layperson. And I have to say, I was completely lost about a few minutes into the lecture. So I started taking notes. I took notes on the slides. I copied exact wording from what he was saying. And I wrote it all over my program and on whatever pieces of paper I could find. And then I took it all and kept it in exactly the same order that I copied it in, and came up with this poem based on his lecture. And so he was a 2017 Nobel laureate, and he was kind enough to agree to let me use the bits and pieces of his lecture. He said, "How did I say all that? And how did it turn into a poem?" Well, here it goes. So then that's when I discovered that academic science could make poetry. Tick more slowly. Binary in spiral, merging black holes. Waveforms, matched templates. Chirps, ripples of space-time, stretch, compress, change human hair. Suspended mass vibrations, splitting the fringe, shaking. Barely feel. Detector sees nothing. Brighter and slower. Desert under high vacuum. As the instrument evolves, scatter back in seismic noise. Isolation from Earth. Reduction in the shaking. Never saw gravitational waves. Have to know the direction at room temperature. Quantum noise, radiation, all just hard, straight light, little vertical spikes, all harmless. Never saw gravitational waves. The improvement inspired the dress design. Many oscillations change the shape. Those curves, tiny, 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 real potential here, merge within the lifetime. Problem for the future. Normalized the so-called chirp signal. It had been predicted before Galileo looked through a telescope for the first time. So that's a little strange, but it kind of opened the door for what you can do. And by the way, the Nobel Prize that lecture was based on was about the or acknowledging the discovery of gravitational waves and the graphing of them and so on. Okay, I'm going to read something from the book now. So conversations are a big part of how I write, and writing down what people say in a lecture or just in a conversation. This is based on a conversation I had with Professor Aaron Vincent over there in Sterling Hall. And maybe you have a preconceived notion of what an astrophysicist is like, or what a physicist is like generally, and maybe you think they're kind of dull or boring or introverted or who knows what. I don't know what you think a physicist is like.
It's never crossed my mind.
Let's say with a better model. Where's this going?
But honestly, they are funny people. They have the strangest sense of humor you can't even imagine. And they are very funny in a kind of understated way. So I had a really fun chat with Aaron Vincent. This poem is called Talking to a Theoretical Astrophysicist. My friends are excited that I'm meeting with a physics professor who is open to questions. Can you ask about creativity? About inspiration? Can you also ask about time, if you have time? About whether there was an immeasurable period of time before the Big Bang? And about when time really began? Or is that looking at time in the wrong way? I get the answer, maybe, to that kind of question. Maybe time is not linear. Maybe time is more curvy. Maybe there are eternal infinities. If our universe developed from an explosion of a small, dense gathering of matter, where did this matter come from? The physicist is kind enough to humor this question, whose most likely answer is, we still don't know. He can probably tell I've completely misunderstood the answers he offers, so he deflects the topic and suggests I look up the term inflaton, pronounced like mastodon, and not a typo, no matter what autocorrect thinks. An exciting theory, an excitation of hypothetical energy fields that propelled early cosmic inflation. But time is moving on, and I have more questions. The ultimate fate of the universe? Energy causes the universe to expand, probably endless expansion. I ask if these things keep him up at night, and whether theorists have to like uncertainties and messiness. No, and yes. What keeps him up is the puzzle of it all, what he calls a giant cosmic murder mystery, frustrating and very suspicious. What a wow kind of job. When each piece you pick up, turn around in your mind, poke and prod with math and experiments, discuss and figure out, yields incredible rewards. Wow, this huge, complicated, elegant universe that somehow includes us. Maybe the amazement doesn't hit him often enough anymore. Maybe too often. I ask about patterns. Does he look for or just notice them? Obvious patterns in his data often mean he did something wrong. Some patterns will only appear if he looks at the results from a certain angle. And yes, there is time for creativity, for inspiration. Yes, to an element of play in theoretical astrophysics. Play with simulations, programs, models. Try to become more creative. Ask different questions. Speculate about answers and other approaches. Expand on someone else's work. I had set a challenge for the physicist. Keep a sense of humor and try to answer complicated questions in a short time. questions that people write whole books about. Time runs out to ask about lists on the blackboard, one column for measurements, one for anomalies. Those two headings could come in handy if I were planning to renovate an old house. Also, no time to ask about another list on that board, full of abbreviations, things that need explanations, BSM, beyond the standard model. Concepts like neutrino masses, quantum gravity, matter, antimatter, asymmetry, and a couple items the list says most probably need to be there, dark matter, and QM on BH, quantum mechanics on black hole horizons. Someone will need an immeasurable period of time to fully explore that list and all its messiness and uncertainties, but it won't be me. Okay, we're going to switch it up here a little bit, and I'm going to bring up three extra readers, friends of mine, who have agreed to provide a little bit of a different kind of poetry for you. So I've got my friend Jane McDonald back there, if you want to come up. She's going to read a couple of poems for you first. Jane came from Wellington, near Picton, and comes to poetry events often in Kingston. And we also, after Jane, we've got Shannon Mulholland, and Shannon came from Ottawa, although she had been based in Kingston. She was an intern with the McDonald Institute in Communications, and she helped me actually put together the order of the poems in this book, so I'm really grateful to her for that help. And after Shannon, there's Sue Publicover, who is a poet and also an HR person at CMC Microsystems, if you know where that company is in Kingston. They are photonics and microelectronics, quantum, or whatever. Hey, whatever, Sue can tell you what she does. Okay, so Jane McDonald.
Hi, everyone. First of all, Meg, congratulations on a wonderful book. So enjoyable. You just nailed the voice. Thank you so much. I'm really, really enjoying it. Yeah, so Vladimir Nabokov said, we must write with the precision of poets and the imagination of scientists. And I think you nailed it. Thank you for inviting me to read. So I have... How's that? Is that better? Excellent. So I was had the fortune to have a little retreat, I guess you'd say, a writing retreat in the, I live in Prince Edward County, and there's a lot of limestone buildings there with thick, thick walls, and I had the privilege to stay for a little while at the Hillier Hall. Well, I guess you guys here in Kingston are used to thick walls, but they never fail to thrill me. Anyway, this one is called, It's Wonderful to be Alive. There can be good reasons to keep out the light. This town hall, built at Confederation, small windows in thick limestone walls. In the latter half of the 1880s, glass panes were dear and heating more troublesome than lighting a dim interior. Historical photos show the windows have been enlarged, which would have meant cutting through stone. I felt sad when I heard Hudson sold his farm. What will he do with those buff Orpingtons? Their frilly rumps decorated my drive past his fields. Show me a prosperous farm and I'll show you a dairyman, farmers of the future, red-cheeked 4-H exhibitors and all-white parading around the ring, their prize cows bawling and unmilked, the better to show. And yet, animal husbandry, the bland, optimistic elaborations of cheese, a toasty, washed, rind tongue. I drive, a pleasure of mine, aimlessly for miles on country roads. What do the old people grieve? A finch in autumn molt settles on one of the 7-foot-tall helianthus, nudges each black center the way a lamb does the udder. The bird tugs one of the seeds free, then arrows over the split rail fence to the bank of coneflowers every householder seems to grow these days. I'm grateful echinaceas provide sustenance, as similarly I was for the Dutch clover in the Southwest Ontario Park, where I spooked my lover's body on the ground, bumblebees too numerous to count, browsing at ground level the trefoil's million identical florets. The flower tolerates the municipality's riding mower, its weed suppression and fertilizing regimes that keep the public space presentable, standard compliant. The outdoor people, whose shoes give them away, periodically passed a short distance from where we lay. It seemed the park was a thoroughfare, a short, perhaps from one secret place beside the scented river to another by the creek. The kinship of lying down in public. We had nowhere else to go, weren't from that town, we needed to rest. The white municipal pickup that slowed had me calculating our right to be there, our assets on the grass, tidy and white as we are, a non-crumpled grocery bag of food beside us under the towering Norway maple, though our clothes were must a bit by then. The river is called the Thames. The past is a graveyard of the living gone before us, whose rivers are starless. The forgetting is without end. It comes on slow, creeps into the leaves, and pushes out the color. Thank you.
Congratulations, I think that book looks so awesome and it's so great. Super jealous that you're going to be a poet in residence. That's such a cool experience. And thank you for having me read. When Meg asked me to read, I was like, oh no, I don't have any science poems. But then my partner was like, weren't you studying a chemist, like writing poems about them? Oh, okay. Louder? Okay. Quiet person. My partner had mentioned that, oh, weren't you writing a collection about a chemist before you started a PhD? Like, I don't remember anything before PhD. So I had to dust these off. So I was. I was writing poems about Clara Immerwahr, who, if you don't know, was a German chemist. She was the first German woman to be awarded the doctorate in chemistry from the University of Breslau. But she's more her other half is more famous, who is Fritz Haber, who was kind of the father of chemical warfare. And so her accomplishments and such were overshadowed by his whole thing. So I'm going to read a couple poems, three quick poems about her experiences. I'm kind of known as a writer of bummer poems, and this won't disappoint, unfortunately. Explosion at the Institute, December 1914. Inside the house, a wide surge of pressure stuns the air in Clara's chest. She darts down the stairs before the blast reaches her ears. She shoves through the crowd, men recoil, like spent shells dispersing in the dense smoke. His voice. Poor. Just shards from Fritz's lips as he leans on a bench unharmed. Gerhard flounders past him, hushed, holding his right arm to his chest, lab coat wrapped tight over what once held his hand. But it's in their lab where Clara stumbles to the floor, to the side of Sacher, Otto, her Breslau classmate. The familiar yet unyielding face perched across from her, hurt during her final doctor defense, destroyed, eyes, nose, mouth, irreparable, bloody pulp, his brain visible through shards of pieces of skull, crude and imperfect, like soiled sketches in her textbook. She pulls back the collar of his starched shirt, his chest still swelling with air. Told you. bread from air. In the absence of husbands and sons dispersed to the front lines, the women and children tend to shrinking livestock in fallow fields, their milk unfit for consumption. In town, the ration queues twist around storefronts, inactive buses, and the dull-hipped horses weave lines of women, slight with pregnant bellies, swaying with babies on their hips, pacifying the ache. Older children are tasked to hold wallets stuffed with ration cards in lines for a chance for scarce fodder. Together, they draw dark rings around their eyes. In the institute, Fritz, shaved bullet head, rolls his shirt sleeves, annoyed by how its creases are weak, inadequate. For those who spend their days processing bread from air, ammonia, waiting for the end of the day to return home and retrieve the delicatessen's fresh lobster mayonnaise from the cellar. The other bummer part about Clara is she killed herself by shooting herself in the chest. Real bummer, but makes for really good poems, unfortunately. We only touch on that. I saved the suicide poem for another day. Recoil. Hours before the celebration, Fritz's return from the Western Front, it brought cutlery to glasses and glasses to lips, and lips to others' stained napkins still piled in the kitchen. The dampened voices now stray from her ears. She presses her feet into the lawn and his revolver against her chest, the closest contact she's had with him in months, so both so easily slipped from his attention. Thank you.
I feel like I should start with Monty Python's "And Now for Something Completely Different." I had a lot of fun. Meg asked me to read when we did sort of a special science night at Quirks of Human Nature, and it was so much fun and totally out of the type of writing that I do. And so I was really flattered. Meg, you've been a great encourager. I'm so delighted with this project and your work, and I'm always amazed and delighted with what you bring to us. It's wonderful. So I don't have a quote from Vladimir about art and science. I have one from Rumi. Our confusions have always been a part of our riches, so I figure either I'm going to read something that you like, and that's the gift. Or if you're confused, then you're really rich, right? So, like the last time, I did a fast write before I came, and Meg did ask me to bring the matter poem that I read before. So I'm going to start with drawing, move to matter. And there might be a bit of a dark hole in both of them, but maybe not the way you would think a dark hole would appear. Drawing. I'm drawing a picture for you. Drawing up a plan. Drawing near the fire. Drawing on my experience. Your experience. Everyone's experience. I'm drawing the water while hummingbirds are drawing nectar, and the sun is drawing towards the horizon. Drawing the curtains. Day drawing to a close. Drawing your attention to something. Fear. Drawing nigh. I try drawing a boundary. I fear the drawing and quartering of flesh. The prize drawing of the hunt. Is the world drawing to a close. We are drawing shallow breaths, drawn together in our horror. But now, I am drawing a hole. On paper, with a pencil. Drawing thick lines to fill the center, placing it on the floor. Beckoning the dark hole, begin its pull of blackness. Drawing in all the chaos, then silence. Drawing us closer to peace. Drawing long, quiet breaths. In the beginning was the drawing out and the drawing in, and it was good.
Sorry.
This one was fun. I was thinking about matter. And what I knew of matter and how little I knew of matter and what was the matter with my knowledge of matter. And this is what I wrote with much joy and fun for the last time we talked sciencey. The matter of dark matter. Because it matters. Or does it? Ordinary matter makes up everything. I mean everything we see and touch. Planets, stars, people, spider webs, seed pods, babies' fingers, toes, taut thighs, skin through clothes, a rose. You get where I'm going. There is not much ordinary about ordinary matter. With my poetic license, which could be revoked at any time, I call matter extraordinary, infinite. Whether scientific fact or my wild fiction, it is delicate, rough, breathtaking. Sweet, sour. I do not perceive an end to it, you know? Like that old box of Tide, going back to the 60s, that old box of Tide, which had a picture of a woman holding a Tide box, which had another picture of a smaller woman holding a Tide box. Holding a smaller box of Tide. I just stared at that box a lot when I was little. Except in my view, the matter evolves. It gets more complex and more beautiful the smaller it gets. So what's the crux of the matter here? Is it a matter of fact or the matter before us, or mind over matter? I will bring a close to this matter and reflect on my own matters, but wait. What if it's dark matter, hypothetically speaking? Well, that's just a black hole I'd like to avoid for now.
Thank you, Jane, Shannon, and Sue. That was really fun. And I have been negligent in not bringing up all the McDonald's to people who want to say something. So, Edward, Thomas, or Zach, or Mark, or Art, or anyone. I know Edward has some prepared remarks here. So Edward Thomas is the Associate Director of the McDonald Institute, and really the one who helped me start this whole residency on a good, on the right foot. Yes.
Thank you very much. Okay, so very brief remarks just on what this project has sort of meant to us at the Institute. So first, we're thrilled to celebrate the publication of Big Questions, Tiny Moments. I would like to thank Meg, our poet in residence, for her dedication and her passion in pursuing this project. Now, Meg, when you approached us last year with a vision of creating a book of verse inspired by astroparticle physics, it was pretty easy to say yes, and yeah, maybe we're an easy mark, since the whole field's concern is to understand the biggest structural questions in the universe by studying its smallest structures. So poetic imagination, invention, irony comes pretty easily to this group. You know, about this science, we're a rather large grouping of people from around the world, really, devoted to still unresolved properties of neutrinos, the nature of dark matter, the dominance of matter over antimatter in the universe, and, of course, the very origins of our existence. So this encompasses a unique set of human experiences, right? All these people chasing after these questions. You know, those experiences are sometimes mundane, sometimes they're stressful, they're often stressful, and oftentimes they're wildly adventurous. And for nearly 20 years, we've been collaborating in one form or another with painters, sculptors, philosophers, dancers, and musicians to try and make sense of this experience of the scientists, the students, and the general public that supports this work. So what these collaborators do for us, what Meg has just done for us, is really to help us bridge the gap between making knowledge out of what we do and then making meaning out of what we do. So Meg is really helping us with making meaning. So for myself, Meg's poetry stands out for its engagement with themes of duration and change. As our research endeavors increasingly span multiple decades, hundreds of people, and dozens of nations, we increasingly are confronting the profound human implications of human lifetimes, perhaps multiple lifetimes, in pursuit of a question. Meg's work, with its blend of curiosity, wonderful wry humor, and a keen eye for resonant detail, has really opened my eyes to the way time weaves together the lifetime, the moment, and all the little in-between durations that chronicle the work of astroparticle physics research. So we're honored to have been part of this creative journey with you, Meg, and we're excited to share the results with the world. We hope this chapbook will inspire readers to see the poetry in chasing the smallest possible to apprehend the biggest things. Thank you.
Thank you, Edward, for your kind comments and your perceptive reading of my work. Much appreciated. Deb, you're on. I'm going to bring back my friend and colleague, Deb Shermans. So we're going to show you a little bit of what we do at a show called Quirks of Human Nature, which will be in this location on July 15th and then monthly thereafter on the third Tuesday of the month. We have started, and now 2 years ago, we started a show that we call Quirks of Human Nature that weaves together poetry and improvised live music at the same time. And it's pretty exciting because the musicians and the poets don't rehearse ahead of time. They just do it on the fly. And so the music illustrates the poetry inspires the music, and it's different every single time. It's really, really fun. So Deb has not seen these poems before, except, a couple of days ago, and she's going to illustrate them with her music. Okay. So the first one is a story of, it's a poem, but it's a story
of my trip to Sudbury, which was my second trip to Sudbury back in November. I had been 30 years before when the very first snow experiment was first being built. I was a guest of the scientists, and I was a guest of the scientists again now 30 years later. And it's a different lab down there, expanded, much bigger than it was before. So this is the story of my trip to Sudbury. Rare interactions revisited 30 years on. 5:45 a.m., November 1st, sleet pelting down. Almost no one on the road as I drive out of Sudbury, almost missing my turn off the highway in the dark. Half an hour later, the town of Lively. The liveliest place I've ever seen at that time of day. As if it's rush hour, a long line of cars heading the direction of Creighton Mine. No lighting on that twisty road. Then a sudden blaze of light around the parking lots and buildings, and I'm just in time to meet my guide. Three jack-o'-lanterns, carved with the symbols for electron, muon, and tau, as we enter the snow lab building for security clearance and mine gear. My visitor tag is 007. An open mine cage, shoulder to shoulder with 42 miners. A two-level cage with 44 miners above us. I can't think about that. The rock whizzes by in the dark as we descend the height of 4 CN towers. Hot and humid down in the mine drift. I'm glad for shorts and t-shirts under our coveralls. Keep an eye out for hazards like puddles with who knows what beneath. Keep an ear tuned, too, for those nearly silent electric vehicles carrying miners or supplies. A paper sign on the wall. Danger. Dark matter. I told you about the sense of humor of the scientists, didn't I? Humor helps clear the mind. But we know there's a 50-foot ladder to climb in case of emergency evacuation. It's an active mine, and rock can move. The Creighton mineral deposit angles through the rock diagonally in the shape of a quirky lake with many inlets and fingers. Each new shaft they dig goes deeper. Imagine all that dark, day after day in the winter. Arriving pre-dawn, going down in the dark to the dim tunnels, coming back up at sunset, at the end of a shift, driving home in the dark. At least the snow lab staff can exit the drift into the labs. The same bright whiteness I remember from before. But the days must be long down there, with no windows except virtual ones looking into the universe. Humor helps there, too. On a scientist's helmet, the definition of sarcasm, noun, the brain's natural defense against the less intelligent. When I was first here, pine tree saplings growing a mile underground were a point of pride. Now, top billing goes to the Keurig coffee maker in the shiny new lunchroom. Bonus, someone brought in their leftover Halloween candy. Just for fun, Snow Lab measured low background radiation of food items, chips, rice, chocolate. Doritos had the most. Expensive chocolate less than chocolate, ordinary chocolate. We eat the candy anyway with our coffee. And there's a new sewage treatment septic system. The bacteria get fed, stay happy, and turn waste into inert blocks taken to the surface twice a year. The early morning miners in the cage with us were quiet. But those surfacing with us midday are chatty and laughing, discussing weekend plans and teasing one good-natured guy, his name was Bruno, about why he won't be at work the next few days and whether he's going off hunting. They all sound a little jealous. The cage goes up, then stops, then goes back down. A moment of panic. Is something wrong? No, just picking up a few latecomers. The cage ascends again, then stops for a longer time. Another moment of panic. Just picking up people on the other level. Claustrophobia, easier to hold off if the cage keeps moving. Does everyone who's been down in a mine feel the same relief and wonder I did when I came back outside and saw the sky and trees were still there? Does it become something taken for granted? The sun was shining, the sleet was gone, and I could finally see the landscape along that twisted road to the mine. Forests of birch and pine trees, small ponds, birds. Maybe a physicist's attitude becomes this. When you're looking at neutrinos, the sun never sets. Video games, or do you want a poem about bubbles, or both?
Bubbles.
Both.
Okay, all right. We'll see if we can get some video game music going. So I wrote a series of poems based on very specific detectors in the snow lab. So they're all in these separate kind of cave-like rooms, doing different kinds of things. Interestingly, a lot of them look very similar from the outside, but their internal construction is quite different. And so I have my own ideas about what these things look like from the outside, but this is called Heavy and Light. From afar, Halo looks like a quilt patterned with interlocking circles and rectangular bars on a dark green background. Like some quilts, it's constructed from repurposed materials, but this would be an unwieldy artwork. Helium detectors and 79 tons of lead logs from other experiments, sheltered underground from unwanted cosmic rays in 10,000 liters of water. It could be an interstellar video game in which heavy and light elements must work together to trap the evasive neutrino. Exploding stars, catastrophic events, galactic rally races, and all neutrino flavors. Everyone wants to get in on this game and watch for a supernova to explode, for most of its energy to escape as neutrinos. All three types race to beat the supernova light to Earth, but it's not really a fair contest. Like tiny superheroes, neutrinos can pass through solid matter at light speed and will always exit the collapsing star before the light, maintain their lead. bats. They slam into Halo's lead blocks like micro spaceships, knock those neutrons loose, and if the detectors are quick enough, they snap them up like prey, record them as signals of a supernova. And alerts go out to astronomers worldwide. Most detectors are only sensitive to one neutrino flavor. Halo records all three. Who will be the first to record the signals? Who will be the first to point telescopes at the supernova in time to view the start of its core collapse? A star explodes somewhere in the universe almost every second. But in our galaxy, no supernova for over 400 years. Astrophysics gamers, get ready. Really do have fun, as if they're playing a video game some of the time. It looks like that to me from the outside. Okay, we'll do the bubbles now.
Wow.
The sound of bubbles. What is the sound of bubbles? Depends on their size, how they vibrate, a bubble that collapses abruptly in water creates a strong noisy shock wave. Destructive cavitation caused by a mantis shrimp as it stuns its prey, complete with a burst of heat and light. Some bubbles can be used to detect dark matter. If you create a bubble chamber of liquid like octafluoropropane with super sensitivity to dark matter particles, then superheat it, any particles that enter will give the droplets enough energy to boil. A clue that dark matter particles may have arrived, along with other usual suspects like muons, photons, or neutrons. I watch engineers test the washing station component of GECO 500, a very large dark matter detector. It's like one of the relaxation videos of bubble sounds on YouTube. A mesmerizing ripple of water down the sides of a transparent rectangular box. Inside an even bigger transparent rectangular box. This part of the detector will get washed in such a way for weeks. I wave, and in response, the engineers inside the outer box tap on the sides. The sound of cosmologists